Want entertainment designed just for you? Then check out customizable streaming TV from Xfinity. It makes your life simple, easy, awesome.
Xfinity gives you customizable streaming TV options. Enjoy the most free shows anywhere on any device, and even access your streaming apps right on your TV with X1. Go to Xfinity.com, call 1-800-XFINITY, or visit a store today to learn more. Restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knocks Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you, as always, with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectaculario, pretty much expects the Jazz to lose every single game this year for some reason, co-host Andrew D. Bailey. We are going to finally wrap up our quarter poll report cards. It seems like they've taken forever this time. I'm not really sure why, since they've kind of dipped into three separate weeks. Before we get started, though, I just want to continue reminding, imploring, begging, and pleading with everyone to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. We can also be found wherever else you consume your podcasts. But iTunes is still the best way to let us know that you're listening, that you're out there, even if it's to make fun of my pronunciation struggles, which someone so kindly did in their last review. And also, we do have to get to the most important question of the day. My co-host, who I don't pronounce his last name properly, according to the pronunciation police, Andrew D. Bailey, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I've never once had a second thought about your pronunciation of my last name.
I wish people could hear what goes on in my head before I say a name that I struggle with. I trip myself up too much about it, and I've just always had a problem with phonetics and pronunciation. And even when I try and memorize it or listen to it, I think I get too much in my head. So I need to get a thicker skin for when people point it out.
Listen, there are some play-by-play guys on the radio and TV for NBA teams that can't get all these names right. So, and they're getting paid a lot of money to do just that, so I wouldn't worry too much about it.
I reject you saying that we're not getting paid millions of dollars to make this podcast.
I reject that too. Does that change anything for us?
So some stuff has happened since we last recorded, and we'll eventually get back to the reverse alphabetical order of the Eastern Conference, but I figure we could start with the Chicago Bulls this time, though, just because they had a mutiny, or an almost mutiny, that Robin Lopez and Lauri Markkanen basically stopped them from having. They're not responding well to Jim Boylan's I don't even know what it's called. Is it just old school coaching or shock and awe coaching?
It's college coaching, man.
College coaching?
Yes. This is how college coaches operate.
Well, I feel bad for students more than ever because they should be getting paid and they got to deal with this shit, apparently. But what do you kind of make of that whole thing? I did think it was funny that he didn't compare himself to Pop, but mentioned it that, well, Pop subs out five players at once. It's like, okay, You're not him.
Yeah. I think the whole thing is kind of ridiculous. There's been a lot of comments about the guys who were unhappy, like Zach LaVine and, whoever else led the revolt, for lack of a better term. You got to toughen up, man up, stuff like that. And that's fine. I guess there's maybe a grain of truth to that. But my first reaction was, this is how college basketball coaches treat their players. And he's a guy who was a head coach at a college program for a while. He was the University of Utah's coach. And in college, I think it's fairly easy to get away with that. You're dealing with a bunch of kids. At least half of them are probably teenagers. None of them are, getting paid a salary for what they do. And there's this adult man who's making tons of money just screaming at him every single day. There's so many coaches that think that the in-your-face tactic is the way to go. Constantly running guys. And you need to get guys in good shape for sure. But wind sprints in the middle of an NBA season during a back-to-back, that just doesn't make sense.
Push-ups too.
Yeah, it was just ridiculous. And to expect that that's going to go over well when I don't know what Jim Boylan makes, but let's say he makes like $1 million a year, and you're screaming at another adult man who makes like $20 million a year, I don't know how you could think that was going to fly. Just the sort of economic dynamics of it make it such an odd decision to me. Maybe he's just trying to establish the fact that he's the leader of this ship now, and you know, things are going to go my way for the rest of the season. I need to get everybody on board now. But I don't think these tactics work with college players because I think it shuts most of them down emotionally. And I don't think it's going to work with pros because they're holding a lot of the cards here. So I don't think you have really the same bargaining power if you're a professional coach. One guy who might be able to get away with some of this is someone like Greg Popovich, who's been around for, you know, however long he's been, 25 years, and he's sort of established this already. But if you're an interim coach, and I know they're saying he's not that, but you just don't have the kind of leverage you think you have, or at least he thinks he has.
Do you think he's going to make it into next season? Well, it's not even a matter of if he gets fired or can this season, that would actually be really impressive. But
Jason Pat, who covers the Bulls, he tweeted something about all this last night, and I responded, do you think Boylan makes it to the end of the season? Because it was a realistic thought in my mind that they might not finish the year with him. And he said yes, just because the front office is throwing their full weight behind him. So I guess it sounds like he'll probably make it to the end of the year. I'm not sure he should, but if it continues like this for the whole season, what's the point of bringing him back? I don't really get it.
I'm kind of with you there, and I'm waiting for this to be turned into a think piece on like millennials or this like generation of players, because they complain to the NBA Players Association about work basically during the middle of the season. But I'm just totally with you there, and it's not even. It's fine if he has a little bit more of an abrasive style than Hoiberg, who is so passive, but you can't, even if you're going for the shock and awe effect, like you can, the way he was, even forget the practices, just the way he was belittling players in general. It wasn't like he necessarily called out specific guys in some of his post-game pressers, but where he was just so quick to talk about their crappy effort and their really bad conditioning. It's, on the one hand, you want to respect it, maybe if you say it once as like that shock and awe effect, but just to keep going and going and going, and then to combine it with this, and then you had players who were trying to appeal to him beforehand, before the whole almost mutiny, and apparently he was kind of being stubborn, and I'm not saying he needs to give in, but it can't be a dictatorship either, which is basically what you just described, and it's just so hysterical because the Bulls, still the main culprits of all this are John Paxson and Gar Foreman.
Yeah.
Just for not recognizing this. And that's, I know you were in charge of the key stat, and I didn't read their vitals. So the Bulls are, as you record this, they are 6-22, 29th in offensive efficiency per cleaning the glass, 22nd in defensive efficiency, 28th in net rating. And I gave them a D. I don't know that I expected them to have a better record, but you need to be quietly bad. Like the biggest controversy, I'm trying to think of like a bad team. The biggest controversy the Knicks have is why won't they play Frank Ntilikina, which is fairly big, but it's like
Hawks have like no controversy.
Yeah, okay. There's the except for the fact that they traded the pick that landed Luka Doncic. So,
good point.
But you need to be quietly bad, and they haven't done that, which is just, you know. And I'm not going to criticize how bad they are in offense just because they don't have a point guard and they rely a ton on Zach LaVine. Markkanen's looked good since he come back. I'm in love with Wendell Carter Jr. You were so spot on with him leading in to the draft. Jabari Parker's the numbers, like his per game numbers are fine, but he's a bad basketball player. But there's nothing on this team that, yes, there's the lack of the point guard, I think I already said that, but there's nothing on this team that sticks out where I'm ready to criticize it, other than just the mannerisms of the coach and now the players are thrown in there. So just be quietly bad. That's my recommendation to Chicago. Figure out a way to be quietly, subtly shitty.
I think that's great advice.
I appreciate
that. Be quietly bad. That should be the mantra of every tanking team.
What did you give them?
I gave the Bulls a D as well, for a lot of the stuff that we've already talked about. They're not just a tanking team. They're really seem dysfunctional right now. The GARPAX regime has just gone on for far, far too long. I suppose I should probably pull up their key stat, which actually didn't have much to do with. I thought about doing Jim Boylan's point differential as a head coach, but that didn't seem fair after four games. So, and I actually, I was looking for something negative, and I pulled up LaVine and Jabari Parker when they're on the court together, expecting the defense to just be awful with those two. And it's actually not the defense as much as it is the offense. When Parker and LaVine are on the floor, Chicago is scoring 102.4 points per 100 possessions. That's in the 12th percentile. Their defense is actually slightly above average, 58th percentile. Net 23rd percentile, so bad. But the reason it's bad is because of the offense, mm-hmm. which is maybe something that we should have seen coming. You've got a couple guys there, and LaVine and Parker, who have never – I think LaVine maybe had one or two seasons where he was starting to trend towards some pretty impressive efficiency. But for the most part, they've struggled to be efficient scorers for most of their career. And if those are your two main guys, you're going to have some problems. Maybe Markkanen will help. I looked up his numbers too, and they're actually really bad with him on the floor right now. I think it'll take some adjusting to figure out who needs to play where and with whom. And so, I mean, it's all going to take time, but it's, you have plenty of time when you're a tanking team. I just was surprised that it's the offense more than the defense that's a problem for them right now.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie.
Not that I thought the offense would be good, but I thought the defense would be worse.
We billed them for bottom five in defensive efficiency, did we not? At least I did. I was pretty adamant that they were going to suck.
I did, yeah.
So that the next team, that's the Bulls. You gave them a D2 as well, right?
Yep.
Although the last thing I'll say on them, I really want to see Zach LaVine healthy next to just kind of a different point guard. Like, I know he played a little bit with Ricky Rubio in Minnesota, but I'm not sure if that's a point guard who's willing to pass but can't really shoot, and LaVine was just still so inexperienced by that point. I just want to see him with sort of a different look there, and the Bulls don't have that. You don't need to see him and if you want him to be the primary ball handler, your offense probably isn't going to be good to begin with. And that's part of the reason why I know we all hyped up his efficiency at the beginning of the year, but that's definitely part of the reason why it's plummeted. So, and it's, you know, Cameron Payne and Archie Diacono, they're not going to make that type of a difference.
I better not hear of anyone or see anyone criticizing your pronunciation of Archie Diacono.
Was it that bad?
No, you nailed it.
Oh, well, I've watched too much Bulls this year. something I was thinking last night, and I have no idea why.
Watch somebody get on both of us for mispronouncing it.
Yeah, I mean that's probably what it is. The next team we want to talk about, just because they had the trade, the three-team trade with the Wizards and the Bucks, are the Cleveland Cavaliers. I'll start off with their vitals this time to try and keep some sort of organization to this. The Cleveland Cavaliers are, I was almost going to read the Charlotte Hornets vitals for the Cleveland Cavaliers. I want to let you know that. They would have came off looking
much better.
Their record as we record this is 6-21. They're 23rd in offensive efficiency, 30th in defensive efficiency, 27th in net rating. So the trade turned into, they took on John Henson and Matthew Dellavedova. They acquired a heavily protected first-round pick from the Milwaukee Bucks, and they sent George Hill to Milwaukee. Jason Smith was sent to Milwaukee as well, and Washington also sent Cleveland a 2021 second-round pick, and they took on Sam Decker to cut their tax bill. And the picks that Cleveland received from Milwaukee were, it's a 2021 first rounder, but I doubt it's going to convey then because Milwaukee has sort of Phoenix's has Phoenix, the obligation to Phoenix that doesn't look like it's going to convey this year. And then they received a second round pick from Milwaukee as well. So I liked this, the Milwaukee perspective, and people were getting, there's a tendency to not like when teams use picks to dump salary to evade luxury tax implications. And this wasn't about this year for Milwaukee, but by doing this, deal, they now have the ability or an outside ability, however you want to put it, to re-sign Antetokounmpo, Middleton, and Brogdon without going into the tax, and then having the financial resources, depending on, let's say, Brook Lopez prices himself out of the room exception this year, that then they probably will have the Fulman level exception to kind of work with and give him a new contract. It's not necessarily a given. If you pencil in everyone's contract holds, the Bucks are going to have about $23.4 million in wiggle room under the tax starting next year. A lot of people think Chris Middleton's going to get a max contract, and if he does, that's going to be $13 million of that flexibility is gone, which then leaves you with about $10 million, let's say. But Bledsoe has a hold of about $22.5 million. I don't think he should be getting paid that much next year. Maybe he does, but I would be surprised if he got more than that. And then I would guess that the money that was left, that I was just doing some quick math here and have it in my doc, that should be enough to help them keep Brogdon. And I'm mostly okay with it, if only because, yes, you know what, giving up first-round picks is a problem, but the protections they have on it, there's a chance that it doesn't convey at all if they're bad enough. So if Antetokounmpo leaves or is traded for some reason, and then if you have him, you can still, you're betting that that pick is probably going to be in the bottom 10 or maybe even the bottom 5. And the other thing for me is, or two things is, one, you have to look at this as they weren't going to pay the tax anyway. And so if or didn't want to anyway, or at least not go deep into it. And so if you're going to, just start from that baseline that, oh, they're not going to pay the tax, then this deal is fine. And you also got off money for next year as well. And it wasn't like these were expiring contracts. Both Dellavedova and Henson each sort of have that – they don't sort of have. They have that final year left on their deals. So I think that the trade was fine for Milwaukee. Again, you never want to give up first-round picks. But, hey, there's a chance that it doesn't necessarily even convey. And if it does – and Giannis Antetokounmpo is there, it's not going to be good to begin with. So I know we started the Cavs with the Bucks, but that's just where I sort of am with them in that trade. And the Wizards just giving up another second round pick to trim salary is basically an annual rite of passage.
Yeah. I got to stop tweeting out instant reactions to trades because my heart sort of softened on that one within like 10 minutes. I think one of my first things was a first for George Hill or something like that. And I wasn't like mad at it, but I just thought it made me sort of think a little bit. But then as I thought more and more about it, I like this trade for all the teams, for the reasons that you laid out. Plus I think George Hill can actually help them a little bit this year. And if they're going to make a,
right,
I think they have a legitimate shot at getting to the finals this season. They have, probably the best player in the Eastern Conference. There's a very real debate between him and Kawhi. But I think I would probably take Giannis right now, and that means a lot, especially in the Eastern Conference playoffs. As we've seen over the last, what has it been, 8 years, the best player in the conference has gone to the finals every single time. So now they might have that trump card in their deck, so they're in good shape. As for Cleveland, did you give your grade for them?
No, I was just going to wait till we got into the trade for them. The thing I was surprised with them is, I guess you take on basically $20 million in money for next season, and you're getting – you got three draft picks, none of which are going to convey before 2021, which is probably a little bit surprising, but maybe that says more about the market right now to dump salary.
Yeah, and I'm actually kind of proud of Cleveland because it looks like they are they're sort of in this for the long haul right now, a rebuild. And I usually hate when people do this for grade type stuff, but I actually gave them an incomplete. This will be my first and only incomplete of these grades. But it's because for me to really appreciate what they're doing this season, I think they need to finish off this fire sale, and that includes Kevin Love. It sounds like J.R. Smith might be the next guy to go. They've already moved Korver, George Hill, J.R. Smith looks to be next, and then I think you got to try to move Love as well. See what you can get for all these guys. Restock the cupboard full of draft picks and young players and see where you are in 2 or 3 years, because you're obviously not competing for anything in the next 2, 3, maybe even 4 years. So this is the asset collection phase of team building. And so far I'm pleasantly surprised with what they're doing.
Yeah, I think it took them too long to get there, though, which kind of warps it for me. I ended up giving them a C- just because basically of that. I think an incomplete's fine and perfectly fair, because what if you look at this, and I'll touch upon this with my key stat a little bit, but who can you make sweeping conclusions about on this team after what you've seen this season? I mean, Kevin Love is injured. J.R. Smith is gone. They've traded a bunch of guys. They have a bunch of guys coming in. We're not even sure if, you know, an Alec Burks or even a John Henson or a Matthew Dellavedova are necessarily permanent pieces, because they could be rerouted in different trades if Cleveland's looking to take on even more salary. And so the one you look, it's like it's Chetty Osmond, Sexton, and then maybe Tristan Thompson, who probably doesn't even factor into their future either. Jordan Clarkson's there too. So they have some like rotation staples, and Rodney Hood has had his moments this year, but it all just feels like it's in a constant flux. The rookie, or well, that ruins it. The player that I've been most intrigued and confused by from Cleveland is Colin Sexton. His numbers are just all over the place. And so I have like key stats for him. He is shooting better than 41% on long mid-range shots. He is in the 68th percentile of efficiency, according to Cleaning the Glass, from in all mid-range shots. He's been, I know he's not attempting them in a bunch of volume, but he's been a lot better from three-point range. He's shooting over 45% from there, except almost triple his amount of shots are coming from long two range than they are from three-point range. That's bizarre. His finishing around the basket is not good. There are, and this is, I guess, my most key stat, there are 84 players who have attempted at least 90 shots in the restricted area, and Colin Sexton has the sixth worst efficiency among those 84 players, shooting 51.8% on those looks. And we're going to have to see more from him in terms of developing as a passer as well, because he's just, I know assists aren't everything, but he's averaging under 3 assists per 36 minutes, and that's like since he was put in the starting lineup. So it's just, that's just not a good number, and his, when you look at his potential assists, they're not high enough to say, well, he's making these good passes and teammates just aren't hitting shots. It just doesn't seem like he has that half-court feel there, and maybe it comes. That still, to me, makes him one of the hardest rookies to kind of peg long-term, again, because all these numbers are just all over the place. And there are things you can talk yourself into, like, oh, if he's going to hit all these long twos and shooting well from three, that bodes well for his future. But how is his shot selection going to look? And defenses are going to be able to guard him easier if he's not really finishing well around the rim, or if he's not hitting shots in the restricted area. So he's definitely a rookie to watch, especially once this roster is, I don't want to say finished, but maybe done kind of overturning its pieces. But that's just where I'm at with Cleveland and Colin Sexton, which is to say basically nowhere.
Yeah, I've had some Cleveland fans push back on me and say it's the scheme is the reason he doesn't get assists, and maybe there's some truth to that. But
I mean, he's playing alongside just a bunch of ball-dominant combo guards, so it's possible. Yeah.
But I would still like to see him get some more assists.
Take more threes or something at least. Even if we're not – that was the thing that just – jumped out at me more, is he's shooting well on these long twos, but stop taking them.
But, and I was also going to say, overall, I think he's been better than I expected. I think you laid out a lot of very valid concerns. There's little chance that he finishes the season shooting 44% between 10 and 16 feet, and 42% between 16 feet and the three-point line, and even 45% from three. All those numbers are probably coming down at some point, but he's just been a little bit better than I expected. So kudos to the Cavs for that.
That brings us, now we are heading in reverse alphabetical order, which means that we are moving on to the Indiana Pacers. They are 17-10 as we record this, 20th in offensive efficiency, 2nd in defensive efficiency, and 7th in net rating. What do you have to say about them, Mr. Key Stat Holder?
I gave the Pacers an A, and this is sort of a 2-year grade for me. I still think they did so well in that Paul George trade in the face of all the criticism that I gave it, that tons of people in the media gave it. They got two really, really good players out of that trade. And then another reason I'm giving them an A is because they've played now 11 or 12 games without Victor Oladipo. And they're not only surviving, they're 17-10 and second in the league in defense, like you mentioned, top 10 in net rating. For them to be doing that without the guy who was clearly their best player last season, to me, is really, really impressive. My key stat for them, I'm going to go back to the trade. I think I've seen a few people mention Paul George as an MVP candidate over the last week or so, and you were before all of them. I think you did that like two episodes back. He's been ridiculous. He was unreal last night. I think he deserves these mentions in the MVP conversation that he's getting. His box plus minus right now is 5.5. Domantas Sabonis on the Indiana Pacers, his box plus minus is 5.2. Half of the return for Paul George. He has been unbelievable this season. Here are his per 36 minute numbers. They're just crazy. 20.7 points, 14 rebounds, 4.5 assists, nearly one block, nearly one steal, shooting 64% from the field. His true shooting percentage is 68.5. Talk about an early candidate for sixth man of the year. He has just been fantastic off their bench. And like I said, that's just half of the trade. He and Victor Oladipo coming over from OKC, that was, I just grossly, horribly, terribly underestimated that return for Paul George.
I don't know if there was a single person that liked it. Kudos to Kevin Pritchard for rolling the dice on that then.
Yeah, he nailed it.
I wanted to give them an A, and I promise I'm not oversimplifying. Well, maybe I am oversimplifying this. I gave them a B+, and basically for all the reasons you stated, if you're going to just remain firmly entrenched in the playoff picture, 7 games over .500, when your best player, and not only your best player, but an all-NBA player, an all-NBA candidate, is on the bench watching, that's super impressive. My whole thing, and I talked about this with Indy Cornrose's Caitlin Cooper a few weeks back, is that their shot profile needs to change on the offensive end, especially when you don't have Victor Oladipo. Like, taking more threes is a way of offsetting a variance. And I've talked about this before. I'm not saying all teams should take more threes, even though it probably sounds like I am saying that. But if you're a team like the Pacers, yes, they shoot well on long mid-rangers. I'm still not okay with them ranking 27th in all three-point frequency. It'd be different if they were getting to the line a ton, and I know they spend a bunch of time in transition. That's all fine, and that's what kind of helps keep their offensive float at points. But if you're not going to get to the foul line, if you're not going to take an obscene number of shots at the rim, their 10th in shot frequency that comes at the rim, which is better than last year, you need to take more threes. And the other thing that stands out to me is this isn't even – it's more hypocritical if we're just going to say that assume that I'm flat out wrong in every instance, which is fine. It's more hypocritical of me it's more me oversimplifying the Spurs' situation when I tell them to take more threes than it is for the Pacers, who have some nice shooters on this roster. I mean, Bojan Bogdanović is just shooting the lights out again this year. You have Darren Collison, who's shooting a little bit better of late. He started the season ice cold. I still don't understand why they don't try and up the three-point volume for Miles Turner. You have Corey Joseph, who's shooting over 40%. From three. Tyreke Evans has not necessarily been what they expected. He's shooting under 39% on two-pointers. He's still at 36% from three. You have Doug McDermott over 40% from three. There is a meaningful case to be made that this team needs to up its three-point volume, and it'd be maybe easier to overlook it if Victor Oladipo was in the lineup, but when you're missing your best player, that's sort of a way to kind of bring it up, and they haven't taken a ton of more threes during that time that he's been watching from the sidelines. And a part of that is that he's kind of important to their three-point attack when you just look at someone who wants to create off the dribble and will take the occasional pull-up three. So it's just, I would like to see them do more to work with their offensive shot profile, and I haven't seen it from this season yet, and that's something that bugs me in the last season. And when I was talking to Caitlin Cooper about it, it was just sort of nice to have it reinforced that no, it's not completely out of line. Like it needs to happen. And they are, since Victor Oladipo has been out, by the way, they are 28th in 3-point rate attempt rate. So
yeah,
which is actually one spot worse than they are for the season, which is 27th.
That should definitely go up. I'm with all that. And I like you would like just about every team in the league to shoot more threes. So you're not going to get much pushback from me on that.
That would bring us to the Detroit Pistons, who are, as we record this, one game over 500 at 13-12. They are 24th in offensive efficiency, 11th in defensive efficiency, and 20th in net rating. I was in charge of their key stats, so it seems like we differ on this team quite a bit. I gave them a B, and I think a lot of what's going on with their performance has to do with luck, which is where my key stat will come in. But I'm not sure that I expected them to be just even this competent to watch, maybe. And I know they're super reliant on Blake Griffin. So when he's playing more than 35 minutes a game, you're just a rolled ankle or just sprained knee away from having your entire season torpedoing. They just don't have a ton of talent outside him and Andre Drummond. And it's not even just they don't have talent. It's just not complementary talent. You look at Luke Kennard dealing with injuries, and so that takes away one of your best shooters. Glenn Robinson has not been what they thought he would be. Reggie Bullock has been better from three-point range lately after a really cold start to the year, but 35.1% doesn't cut it. Reggie Jackson just has his off-ball problems still in droves, and that they're still over 500, contending for an East playoff spot. Their defensive rating is in the top half of the league. It just kind of impresses me. But the thing I will say is, though, they are one of the teams that I'm just bracing for serious regression with. If you look at their defense, they are, their opponents on open and wide open threes combined are shooting 32.1% on the year. That number is going to come up.
Yeah.
So, which is what you have to prepare yourself for, and I'm not sure that they can get much better at the offensive end. They're good at kind of preventing threes in general. They're 10th in all three-point attempts allowed by their opponents. But it's just when you're 25th in corner three-point defense, yes, I think they're tops in the league and above the break three-point defense. I didn't look at that. Except when when opponents are missing that many of their wide-open looks, it is kind of just, it probably tilts closer toward a red flag. But again, I think I expected this team to be worse. And if I had a guess, I would have said their identity would have came on the offensive end, not the defensive end. And however you slice it there, they've been better than they're supposed to be on that end of the floor. Maybe another red flag is their most used lineup is not good defensively, but they've been kind of, Dwayne Casey has mismatched rotations a little bit. He's trying to find those wings that are best suited alongside Jackson, Drummond, and Griffin. And I just don't think they're on this roster. It seems like they would need to make a trade. Again, I am bracing for regression, but I could probably be talking to down a B-, but I don't know that we could say this team has underachieved. And I think in some ways they've surprised in a good sense.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. And like you said, I'm a little bit lower on them than you were. I gave them a C+. My biggest reason is I don't think they've found the right guys, and I'm not sure they've even tried the right guys around Griffin and Drummond. And I wouldn't even say the right guys around Griffin, Drummond, and Jackson, because I don't think Jackson is the right guy for those first two. They have a ton of talent in the front court, Blake Griffin and Andre Drummond. That's a great place to start. Spacing issues notwithstanding, I think most teams starting from scratch would probably take that amount of raw talent. That's not a terrible hand to be dealt. I've used the cards analogy like four times today. This is different. But I want to see those two play with all wings, and I think we talked about that before the season started. This season, Drummond, Griffin, and Bullock have shared the floor for just under 800 possessions, and Detroit is actually around plus 7 points per 100 possessions with those three on the floor, 83rd percentile. Now, if you take Reggie Jackson out of that configuration, so Drummond, Griffin, and Bullock on the floor, Jackson off the floor, that configuration is only seen about 100 possessions, which is maybe one full game's worth of time. And Detroit is plus 33 points per 100 possessions, which is in the 100th percentile. I am all for playing those two big guys with wings and just let Blake Griffin sort of be the de facto point guard on offense. I looked up another lineup for them, one that I think I pegged preseason that I wanted to see a bunch of minutes from, and it was Bullock, Kennard, Robinson, who, like you said, hasn't been as good as expected, with the two big guys. And that lineup hasn't seen the floor at all. So I think it's time to get a little bit more creative. You don't need a traditional point guard when you have Blake Griffin in the lineup. He's one of the best passing bigs, really, of all time. He can run a pick and roll, run four or five pick and rolls with those two guys and let your three shooters space out. They don't have a ton of shooting on this roster. So you gotta take it where you can get it. And I'm not sure they've been creative enough lineup-wise. So that's why I gave him a C+.
Can you guess, forgetting about the context of who else is in the lineup, can you guess what the net rating of the Pistons is when Drummond and Griffin play without Reggie Jackson, period?
I'll give you an
over-under because you're always good at these. I'll say net rating over-under of 12.
I'm going to say under because I feel like I've looked this up fairly recently.
Wow, you're good. 10.5 points per 100
which
possessions.
Which is still very good.
They've only seen 300 possessions in that scenario. The other thing I was kind of – when I was doing some research last night that I don't know if I was shocked, but puzzled to see, Jackson has only played 57 possessions without either Griffin or Drummond on the floor. And I know that you don't necessarily want to have both those guys off the floor at once, but that's probably a way to just neutralize his adverse impact that he's having. I guess the best way to do that would be to bring him off the bench, but if you demote him to the second unit, then that becomes another issue unto itself. Yeah. So I'm sort of with you on those things. I don't know what, even if they start playing Jackson less or bring him off the bench or surround them with more wings, I'm not even sure if I'd be interested to see if these numbers held long term, because they've had some success when they play, I think it's Ish Smith and Langston Galloway with another wing and those two bigs. I wonder if it would hold over the long haul.
Well, I think we're working on about 2 years of Ish Smith working better with the starters than Reggie Jackson. So I feel like at some point you got to make that switch. But like you said, a big part of his falling out in OKC was just the fact that he was a backup, and that was to Russell Westbrook. So if he doesn't want to back up Russell Westbrook, good luck explaining to him why he's got to back up Ish Smith.
Hey, Dennis Schroeder wouldn't back up Jeff Teague, and then he's backing up Russell Westbrook just fine. Dennis, man, he's been good this year, but that's besides the point. We are moving on to the Charlotte Hornets, who are at 500, 13-13 as we record this. They are 5th in offensive efficiency, 15th in defensive efficiency, and 8th in net rating. You were in charge of the key stat for them. Is your key stat have anything to do with their point differential?
It does, kind of.
Okay, then go ahead. So I was just going to say what their point differential is the equivalent of for teams' wins, but I'll wait until you finish.
Okay. Well, last season, I think you and I both monitored this fairly closely. Charlotte was way, way worse when Kemba was off the floor last season. I mean, he had one of the biggest net rating swings in the NBA. I think it was – I actually didn't look this up before the podcast, but I think it was like 15 to 20 points for most of the season. So I was expecting the same this year, and when I looked that up, I was pleasantly surprised. They are plus 3.2 points per 100 possessions with Kemba on this season, which is in the 66th percentile, and they're actually plus 5.5 points per 100 possessions when Kemba is off the floor, which is in the 78th percentile. I did not see that coming. Advanced numbers still really don't like Tony Parker, but I think he's done a pretty solid job as the backup point guard for them. Just raw on-off stuff would suggest that. Miles Bridges has been good off their bench. Willie Hernan Gomez has been pretty good this season. This improved bench is something that they really could have used last season. But overall, I still feel like the Hornets are, you know, talent-wise, they should be better than a 500 team. I can't quite put my finger on why. For years now, I felt like this combination of Kemba Walker, Nick Batum, Cody Zeller, Marvin Williams, just on paper makes a lot of sense to me fit-wise. And I've never quite been able to put my finger on why they just seem to slightly underperform every single game. And so maybe I should just accept the fact that they are what they are. But I still think talent-wise, this is a team that should be a little bit above 500 right now.
Their point differential, and as we did say, they are eighth in net rating. Per cleaning glass is the equivalent, and these aren't perfect comparisons, but is the equivalent of a 51-win team, and they're 500.
Yeah, so they are. I think that kind of backs up what I'm saying. They're underperforming their point differential a little bit.
Yeah, it doesn't help that they have not been great in crunch time this year. They beat, was it, I can't remember if it was the Nuggets. They won a close game on Friday night, and I put like an alert out. I was like, I don't even know what to do because the Hornets won a close game. They're 4-9 in contests that enter crunch time, which is just not good. And it's the third worst winning percentage in the NBA in games such as those. I'm with you on everything you just said. I thought his efficiency was masking it for me at the beginning of the season. I thought there was going to be sort of a turning point for Nicholas Batum. It is just not coming. He's like worse than low volume at this point. And you can't have your highest paid player and supposed to be your second option be that. Nicholas Batum is second to last on the Charlotte Hornets in usage rate, in front of only Bismack Biyombo.
Wow, yeah, that's crazy.
So I think this team has more talent than a 500 team. There's probably some, I don't know if you want to call it depth issues at this point, but there come times where you can't play your ideal combination of players, but I do think James Borrego has done, one of the things I singled out for this team is I wasn't sure how they were going to play small, and he's done sort of a great job of doing that with this team. Miles Bridges has looked really good. You've seen Michael Kidd-Gilchrist excel as a four-man and even log some time at the five. So kudos to him for doing that, but I still think it's just kind of a wonky personnel issue. You still need a second person to, I don't want to say explode, but you need a clear number two, and it can't be Jeremy Lamb. It probably can't even be Nicholas Batum, but it was at least supposed to be him. And so where are you going to get it from? And again, they're doing a lot of creative things, which I like. That they've been an offensive fireball whenever Tony Parker and Kemba Walker play on the court this season. I noticed that at the beginning of the year, and then someone tweeted it out again, I think a couple days ago, and the numbers have basically held. They're destroying opponents at the offensive end. But it's also alarming that that's the combination you want to go to instead of playing Malik Monk with Kemba Walker, because Malik Monk just isn't good enough. They really could use, if they're not going to trade Kemba Walker, they need to try and consolidate their assets into just another impact acquisition. Just because, like you said, it's not even just on paper. It's just a lot of the metrics say that they should be better. I mean, their bench is seventh in point differential. That's good. And yet here you are at 13-13. You're losing a bunch of close games. And a lot of that is going to, I would guess, I haven't done enough research on this, would just have to be with what is your offense during those stretches? It's got to be just Kemba. Who are you trusting to create shots in those situations? And it's... If you don't have Batum, if you're not trusting Monk, is it Lamb? There's just a lot of questions with this team when it kind of comes to their crunch time pecking order, and I don't know if that's going to resolve itself. You like that they're being involved in so many close games, but is that a trend that's necessarily going to turn? And I don't think that you can guarantee that it will. Kemba Walker's usage rate in the clutch, I just looked this up while I was stringing everybody along, 45.7. Can you guess who is the number two in usage rate for that team during crunch time?
Jeremy Lamb.
Tony Parker. And his usage rate is almost 20 points below Kemba's in that. So it's just, you can't have it. And I think that tracks with what you look at the roster. I'm actually surprised to see that Jeremy Lamb is fifth on the team in usage rate, under 14 in the clutch. I know there should be lopsided when you look at Kemba and everybody else, but if you want someone finishing plays for you in crunch time that's not Kemba Walker, I think objectively at this point, it should be Jeremy Lamb.
Yeah. Hey, I got a very important announcement before we move on to the Brooklyn Nets.
This is exciting.
You remember just the other day I texted you, I wish net rating swing was like more common.
Yes.
Basketball Reference added it to player pages.
Well, that's cool.
I went to, when you said Michael Kidd-Gilchrist has logged some minutes at the five, I went and checked out his play-by-play data, and it's there. I don't know if it's in the play index yet. I mean, that would just make my week. I probably wouldn't get any work done as a lawyer, which probably wouldn't be great. But
I'm actually not convinced you get any work done now because your stat threads always come in the middle of the day and seem to go on for hours.
Yeah, they can take a good chunk of time.
Are stat threads billable? Have you figured out a way to do that yet?
Yeah, I need to figure out how to make those billable hours. But that's crazy. I love that they have the net rating swings on there now. Anyway, that's going to be the next dead period today is going to be filled with looking at net rating swings.
That will bring us to, I don't know if I said my grade for the Hornets. I gave them a B. I was a little bit easier on them than you. I am getting to the point, though, where I look at Kemba and I can increasingly understand why the Hornets won't move him. They probably should have moved him last season to get more for him, but at this point, it might be a more worthwhile roll of the dice to sign him to a new contract and hope that his trade value increases that way. There's a chance that that deal won't age terribly just because of how well he's playing, and I'm not sure he's, even if he gets a fifth year, I don't know that he's going to command max money. So we'll see, but I'm warming up to the idea. Potentially as a last resort, because I don't know what you get for him now. He's worth so much more than you're ever going to get for him on an expiring contract. And they probably missed the boat last year. But just looking in the context of this season, I'd probably just let it ride into free agency. Unless you know that he's leaving, unless you give him a five-year max, I'd probably roll the dice.
Yeah, I think I'd be fine with that.
The Brooklyn Nets, they are 10-18 at this recording. 18th in offensive efficiency, 21st in defensive efficiency, 22nd in net rating. I gave them a B-. I was in charge of the key stat for them, which is actually going to – funny that we were talking about with the Hornets. They have a lot of the same problems when you look at their performances in close games, so spoiler alert there. I've seen some criticism floating around of Kenny Atkinson on Twitter because of how Brooklyn has struggled during crunch time. And so I'll start there.
That's exactly where that comes from.
Yeah, the Nets are 5-12 in games that enter the clutch play, which is the second worst winning percentage in the NBA. There's also, this kind of stands out to me. So when they play in the fourth quarter and there's a tie, they're 5-7. When they play in the fourth quarter and have a lead at some point between 1 and 5 points, they're 6-7. When they play in the fourth quarter and they have a lead between 6 and 10 points, they're 5-6. So there's overlapping data in there, but I'm just saying the Nets have held a 6-10 point lead in the fourth quarter 11 times this year, and they have a sub-500 record in those games. That's obviously not great, Bob. Yeah. I don't understand where the criticism of Kenny Atkinson is necessarily coming from, though. This roster still isn't, when you look at it, there are players that you're intrigued by. I love Spencer Dinwiddie. You love D'Angelo Russell, who deserves every bit of love that comes from you. Caris LeVert was really good before he went down. Josh Harris, who just recently returned from injury, he's a great shooter. Jared Allen, super fun to watch. But this isn't a team that has a ton of even, can you say B-plus talent? I'm not trying to insult anyone because I think Spencer Dinwiddie's really good. But you definitely don't have that A-plus talent. You don't have an A talent. You don't have an A-minus talent right now. The guys you're waiting on to become that, LeVert, before he was injured, you're waiting on him to develop still. The same thing with sort of D'Angelo Russell. You have Alan Crabb, who's basically been useless for them this season. Man, me panning for him during 2016 free agency looks utterly awful. I just don't – why? What do you want more from him? I'm not – yes, they could have a better record in close games. You know what I'm more tantalized by or disarmed by? That they've been in 17 crunch time games so far, which is tied for the league lead with the Lakers, Clippers, and Nuggets, all of whom are playoff teams right now. So I'm not trying to give them a pass, and that's where sort of the B-minus comes from them. You would hope they pull out some of those games. They made some just bad decisions down the stretch where guys are committing bad turnovers or just not taking care of the ball. They've had trouble inbounding the ball even. But this team is still not supposed to be good, and yet despite what their point differential says, despite what their record says, they're actually kind of good. It's not even a matter of they're fun to watch, which they are. They are on that sort of competence scale. If they could figure out how to close out more of these tightly contested games, we're talking about if you even tilt 3 or 4 of those games in their favor, they're all of a sudden like in the Eastern Conference playoff picture, like firmly in there. So I don't understand the criticism for Kenny Atkinson at this point. If he had a team with players that was supposed to win these games, supposed to even be in these games, supposed to contend for a playoff spot, I get it. But we don't get to look at the Nets situation and say, oh, just because he's in year three, we need to see something more from this team. Because I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Yeah, and sometimes it takes teams literally years to figure out the late game stuff. And that's for a team that has the same general core for the whole time. It takes a while for NBA players to figure out how to win close games, generally speaking. So I agree with you that the fact that they're in a lot of these games, I think that's a positive sign. I gave them a B minus as well. I really wish the D'Angelo Russell, Spencer Dinwiddie minutes together worked better. I've been pounding that drum for 2 years now. I didn't think that they played enough together last season, and so the numbers weren't great last year either. And I just kind of chalked it up to, well, they didn't get enough time to gel. It wasn't large enough sample size to make any analysis of it. This year they've played a decent amount together, and it still hasn't been good. I don't have that pulled up, but I did in the last week or so, and it's not going well. And both of them are, like, the net ratings are quite a bit better when one is on without the other. So they do pretty well on their own. They're just, for some reason, it's not working together at this point. The numbers that I do have pulled up, and I thought about giving them a little bit lower grade, but I bumped them up to a B minus because prior to the Caris LeVert injury, their net rating was minus 0.3. And then since the Caris LeVert injury, their net rating is minus 2.9. He was, before he went down, their best player. I mean, that's not a stretch to say that, right?
No, it's just a fact.
Yeah. So, I mean, just about any team in the league loses their best player for as long as he's been out now. And it looks like it was 14 games before and 14 games since, so exactly half the season at this point. Any team loses their best player for half the season, and they're going to struggle. I don't think that should be unexpected for the Nets to be struggling the way they are. And like you said, even with all the struggles, there's a lot of positive signs. So I'm going to give them a B- with a big emphasis on the fact that they haven't had their best player for half the year.
Yeah. And D'Angelo Russell has kind of suffered with his shot quality during that time. He's been... I don't know if you've looked at his numbers since the Caris LeVert injury. He's been all over the place. There have been a lot of good games that Philadelphia...
It's kind of D'Angelo Russell's career at this point.
Yeah, he might be one of my favorite NBA roller coasters. And I know I'm far more lukewarm on him than you are, but this is the only guy in the NBA who could sandwich between a 2-of-10 performance against Minnesota and a 6-of-25 performance against Utah, a 16-of-28, 38-point performance against the Sixers, I think that was. So he's had good games.
I told you like maybe a couple months ago, or maybe even a month ago, that I'm like 1 foot off the D'Angelo Russell bandwagon at this point. It's getting harder and harder for me.
I'm very interested to see what they do between another underrated part of the Nets season. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson has not been the player that they really thought he could be, or not thought he could be, but even that he was last season. You know, he's not going to space the floor, but you kind of hope you get more out of his mid-range game. And he's supposed to be this huge defensive difference maker. It's just his first restricted free agency. I don't even know if it's going to be fascinating anymore. It might even be just flat out surprising to see that they keep him. I mean, he shot 47.7% between 10 and 16 feet last year. He's shooting 26.7% from there this season. Even his efficiency around the rim has dropped and floater range has dropped. He's always kind of shot okay on long twos and really small doses, but he's yet to make a shot from there this season. I'm more interested, though, obviously, to see what kind of happens with the Russell and Dinwiddie contract situations. Dinwiddie's extension eligible now, and I think his number is about $48 million is the max he can get, 4 years, $48 million. I'm not sure whether I'd be taken aback if the Nets extended him or not. I don't think that you can invest in both him and D'Angelo Russell moving forward, though. Just because, as you said, it's not just that the numbers have been bad with them on the court to date. It's also that you have Caris LeVert. And then you have to plan he's extension eligible this summer. There's too much overlap there when you look at guys who need the ball. You know, Dinwiddie and LeVert are a little bit better playing off the ball, methinks, instead of D'Angelo Russell, who's shooting really well on catch and shoot threes. this year, though. I just think that having more than two of them on the docket, particularly on different deals than they are now, would end up being overkill. And I think just because D'Angelo Russell still kind of has that star quality, I might be a little bit higher on Dinwiddie, but I like plug-and-play guys, and he's definitely more plug-and-play. It wouldn't surprise me if they ended up shopping Dinwiddie towards the trade deadline just to see what he could get for him. Especially if, what if they offer him? I get the sense that if they offered him the full boat, the full extension, he would accept it. But if he doesn't, or if he doesn't accept the number close to that, then you have to start reconciling, oh, well, how much is he going to cost when he hits the open market?
Yeah, I think that's all. They certainly have some questions to answer here coming up in the near future, especially concerning those two. I think those are all valid concerns.
That would bring us to the Boston Celtics, who are at this recording 16-10. They are 12th in offensive efficiency, 3rd in defensive efficiency, and 5th in net rating. They've been probably one of the more disappointing teams this season, but they do seem like their offense is kind of starting to hit a groove. They're in the top 10 of offensive efficiency since the start of November. They're playing, I don't know if you could say that they're playing better in crunch time situations so much as they're just not putting themselves in those types of situations where they've had some more decided victories, because they're still under 500 in crunch time performances since November 1st. It's starting to turn a little bit over the past few games, and Jaylen Brown has been a lot better since his return. He's been bad overall this season. I've just been very, concerned about their offense when Kyrie Irving is not on the floor. And so sort of my key stat with them is last year when Horford played without Irving and Hayward, since he didn't really play last season, the Celtics were a plus 8 points per 100 possessions. This year, when Horford plays without Irving and Hayward, they're negative 18.9 points per 100 possessions. Their offensive rating during that time is an 86.4. And when you look at, I did an article on this, and the numbers have, again, shifted a little bit from there. But when you look at most of the players in their minutes without Kyrie Irving, the offense is just not good. Hayward's has started to turn a little bit. The Celtics are a plus 0.6 overall when he plays without Irving, but the offense still isn't great in those situations. It's in the 31st percentile per cleaning the glass. When Jason Tatum plays without Irving, the Celtics offensive rating is 101.3, which is the ninth percentile. And it sort of goes on and on and on. It's the same for Jaylen Brown. When he plays without Irving, the offense, 96.7 offensive rating, the second percentile. Terry Rozier has actually had basically the most success out of anyone playing without Irving when looking just at point differential. The offense is still in the 13th percentile when he's playing without Kyrie Irving. They need to, for a team that has so many guys that are supposed to be, I don't want to say offensive hubs, but are definitely supposed to be able to bridge those minutes, it's slightly alarming. And again, it's kind of, over the past couple games, basically since Jaylen Brown's return, there's been a lot of better moments. I want to see if it holds or what happens when they start moving more of the key guys back into the starting lineup. That's just definitely something to monitor, because their offense, they don't get to the rim a ton as it is. They don't get to the free throw line a ton as it is. But when you take Irving off the court, it's even harder for them. I actually think their free throw rate's a little bit more higher, but they don't get to the rim nearly as frequently. I think it's 6% fewer of their shots come at the rim when he's off the court per clean the glass. Something needs to kind of give there. And it hasn't been, Jason Tatum improving his shot profile hasn't changed it. Al Horford's been up and down. He seems like he needs some guys around him to at least hit more of their open looks. They're dribbling into more of these low-efficiency pull-up jumpers when Kyrie Irving isn't on the floor. I just want to see that long-term. And again, it looks like it might be able to turn if Jaylen Brown's going to play this well. And Gordon Hayward, the minutes with him without Irving have improved too. It's just something that I don't know if I've found fascinating, but it could potentially be damning if it doesn't turn. And I gave them a B-, if I didn't say that already.
Which is also what I gave them. I actually had C-plus written down, but right as we got to it, I bumped them up a little bit, because they have been, I think they've been quite a bit better over the last couple weeks. They got off to a slower start than expected. Everything that you just laid out is,
The Horford split surprised me. I'm not going to lie. I know it's been yeah. lower volume, but that really, that got me.
It, yeah, that surprised me too. Cause he was huge for them last season. And like you said, when you've got Jason Tatum, who was, he was crowned something before the season started. I don't know what, but he sure had a lot of hype coming into the season. You have Gordon Hayward, who understandably was coming back from a pretty serious injury, but he's another guy that probably should be able to handle some non-Kyrie Irving minutes. Al Horford, you have enough guys that you should be able to at least survive when Kyrie Irving's not on the floor. And like you said, that just hasn't been the case. I actually think you mentioned when they start working guys back into the starting lineup, I kind of hope they keep the starting lineup the way it is.
That starting lineup's been good offensively. Which
yeah.
is what they've done.
It's Kyrie, Marcus Smart, Jason Tatum, Marcus Morris, and Al Horford. You get a little bit more toughness in the starting lineup that way. I'm not saying anything real original here. This is something that I think a lot of people have talked about. Marcus Smart and Marcus Morris, I think, bring a little bit more of an edge to that starting group. And I think the more, I mean, it's not ideal to have your $30 million a year player coming off the bench in Gordon Hayward, but I actually think that he could grow into that role and be pretty important for them off the bench as sort of like the point forward off the bench. And you have him with Jaylen Brown off the bench. You just have a little bit more firepower in that second unit than you do before, obviously. Daniel Tice, I think, is still pretty good. You can put together a pretty solid bench even when you have Smart and Morris in the starting lineup. So I like that change that they've made. I don't know how long they'll stick with it, but I think that's a big reason that they've sort of turned things around here in the last couple of weeks.
If you wanted to nutshell my key stat, the Celtics are 19 points per 100 possessions better at the offensive end when Kyrie Irving is on the floor. With your take, I agree, and I guess the numbers agree now too. I was concerned about, particularly with Jaylen Brown being there as well, how does that impact Terry Rozier, who hasn't been that great this season, and now all of a sudden you're asking him to really never get time with fewer, I don't want to say ball-dominant players, but guys who'd like to have the ball in their hand. But since Gordon Hayward's been on the bench, Terry Rozier is actually shooting 44.3% from the field and 41% from three. So maybe there's something to that, to kind of, you're ensuring he dribbles into less contested two-point jumpers, which is something he's done a lot this season. But he's also been the type of player who does that no matter who's on the floor. So maybe they found something there, but that'll be interesting to monitor. That brings us to the final team, the Atlanta Hawks. They are 6-20 as we record this, 30th in offensive efficiency, 24th in defensive efficiency, 29th in net rating.
Okay, I actually lost the tab that I had my key stat for them, but I'm going to pull it up real quick. I gave them a C just because I don't think they're any better or any worse than I expected them to be. But here is my key stat. Trey Young, who you predicted I would talk about, -6 box plus minus, mystery player X, -2.1 box plus minus. Trey Young, 469 true shooting percentage. Mystery player X, 511 true shooting percentage. Trey Young, 24.3% from three. Mystery player, 36% from three. I could go on and on. I'll do one that actually favors Trae Young. Trae Young, 38% assist percentage. I just blew it. Mystery player, 24.5% assist percentage. Now that I've given you the first name, do you know who the mystery player is?
I'm just gonna say no for fun's sake. do your big reveal.
rookie Trey Burke.
Yeah.
Trey Young has objectively not been great this season, and I know we've had this back and forth before on the podcast. It is encouraging that he's able to get these shots off, that he has the confidence to take these shots. I think all that stuff is really, really important. At some point, I would like some kind of run of like two or three games in a row when I can see that he can actually make some of these shots. I've done the numbers on this a few times now. Dating back to the turn of the calendar year, which goes back to about halfway through his college season, he has shot the ball terribly. And yeah, he's taken a lot of tough shots, but we're looking at a really big sample size now of a guy who's shooting Stephen Curry shots and converting them at like a Charles Barkley rate. It's not great. I'm not ready to give up on him yet, but I think that people should probably be a little bit more concerned than they are.
I just don't. I'm encouraged by the passing and the degree of difficulty on his shots.
Yeah, the passing, I think he deserves a lot of credit for.
The thing I will say, though, is what was kind of sustaining him was the way he was finishing around the rim or just finding ways to make plays on drives. Up till November 15th, he was shooting 58.2% on drives. Since then, however, he's shooting 43.5% on drives and not getting to the foul line on them. So yeah. I'm not ready to give up either. It's clear that if I were the Hawks, this is from the beginning, I would have taken Luka Doncic, but they're still in sort of a wait-and-see mode. You have to see where Dallas's pick ends up. But if we're going to assume that Dallas is going to hover around 500 for the entire year, the Hawks decidedly lost that trade. I'm still, when I see what Trae Young does as a passer, playmaker, just some stuff he can do off the dribble despite going up against guys who are a lot bigger. And again, the degree of difficulty of his shots, if they start to fall at even just, like you said, if you go through a two or three game stretch where he gets hot, that's going to be huge for him. I don't really have, I'm kind of like a Trae Young stan in the Hardwood Knox text box because you just crap on him all day I'm just kidding. But it's really tough. But the other counterpoint is like who the Hawks have around him. They've dealt with so many injuries. Even now, Torian Prince being out is just, I don't even think it's low-key bad for this team. It's high-key terrible because he's probably your second-best shot creator or maybe third-best if you want to throw Jeremy Lin in there, who's been dealing with his own back issues. You have – who else do you have beyond that? Kent Bazemore, I guess he's fine. So you don't have a ton – you don't have another player who can, one, do what Trae Young can. If at least you can say that – if you're talking about Jeremy Lin as your second-best ball handler or shot creator, then that's a problem. If you're talking about Torian Prince or DeAndre Bembry or Kent Bazemore is your second or third best ball handler, then that's a problem. So I don't know that he has the weapons around him to leverage what he does best just yet. But again, I agree with everything you said.
You know who else deserves a mention, an actually good mention, is John Collins. I think he's pretty underrated at this point. He's averaging 18 points, 8 rebounds, almost 3 assists in under 30 minutes a game.
Is that his agent calling you to thank you?
somebody got it, thank goodness. The per 36 minute numbers on him are 23 points, almost 11 rebounds, over 3 assists. He's been stellar. I put up a poll the other day. Who would you, and I want to hear your answer on this, if you had to pick one to build a team around, would it be John Collins or Trae Young?
Build a team around?
Yeah.
It would be Trae Young. I don't think John Collins does what you need a cornerstone to do to build around a team.
I went with John Collins, and so did the voters, just for the sake of...
Forgive me for not giving up on a rookie one quarter of the way through the season. God, Andy.
John Collins is only 21, too. I think he's really, really good.
He's really good, but is he... Objectively speaking, isn't it better to take a shot on this off-the-bounce creator when you look at today's NBA? And John Collins is not this fantastic defensive hub.
No, he's not. But I think this probably just comes back to our difference of opinion on where Trae Young might end up.
That's also very fair. John Collins' assist percentage, by the way, is over 17.
Yeah. I think he's just been really, really solid. But like I said, they haven't really... They're not really blowing anyone away one way or the other, good or bad. So I think C is probably a fair grade that we both gave them. And with that, we have now graded all 30 teams. It basically took us from the quarter point to the third point, but I think that's fine. We're both pretty busy guys. So is there anything else you wanted to hit on before we wrap this up?
No, that's it. This was our longest one. Of course, the one where we needed to talk about the Bulls, Cavs, and Hawks ended up being the longest quarter point podcast.
All right, well, until next time then, if you want to argue with us about any of these grades, you can find Dan at Dan Favalli, F-A-V-A-L-E. I totally lost my train of thought while spelling your name. On Twitter, I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor is at NBA_math. As always, we would sincerely appreciate more ratings, reviews, subscriptions. If you've already done all those things, please share the show with your friends and family. If you like good NBA conversations, then this will, I promise this will make the holidays so much more peaceful and harmonious as you talk about NBA basketball and the Hardwood Knox takes, as opposed to politics, religion, and whatever else might cause some strife in your family. Until next, I leave you with the shout out to Bena Udry and Kyle Anderson.
Psst. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Holiday Inn Express wants to let you in on a little secret. There's still time to get at least 20% off at holidayinnexpress.com during our annual sale. We'll even throw in free breakfast. Just kidding. Breakfast is always included in your stay at Holiday Inn Express. Book now and save at holidayinnexpress.com. Terms apply.